The story is quite literally straight out of Shakespeare. It's essentially a streamlined version of Macbeth with the setting shifted from Scotland to feudal Japan. In this case, the main character is a samurai warrior, spurred on to steal the throne, both by a witch's prediction and his ambitious wife, even if it means killing the man who currently sits on it.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Let the Movie Speak. My name is Travis.
Hey, everyone. I'm Justin.
Whoa. You're going to have to slow down. That's Justin. And as promised, because we promised this, I think we promised this.
We always come through on our promises.
We always come through on our promises.
Unless they're stolen from us in cold, wicked sinfulness.
Or if they're bad and we shouldn't have promised them in the first place. But this is a good promise.
We've got Annie.
Yeah.
We have a guest, and her name is, you guessed it,
Annie. Jehoshaphat.
Jehoshaphat. Thanks, Justin.
We're happy to have you back. Thanks for coming.
I just want you to know that is my favorite part of the musical Annie.
Oh, I did. Okay, so when we were messing around trying to figure it out, I was like, what song should we use? I mean, and the whole thing is called Annie. I was like, do they ever say Annie?
No.
No, but it's like...
That's the only song where they actually say her name in a song.
Wow. And we found it. We dug deep into track 4 of the movie soundtrack.
But it's a really great dance number at the same time. And it's really fun.
Is it only in the 96 or is it in the old one too?
It's in the, what, the 80, 79, whatever that one is.
Okay, the one with Carol Burnett.
Yes, the real one.
Yeah, well, okay. I hate to break it to you, but I think this track is actually from the
new one. Don't tell me that.
Well, it's not, and I lied. And I always keep my promises, right, Justin?
That's right, except when we lie through our teeth.
I am going to say promise kept, and I am, what is the word I'm looking for?
Delighted. You're delighted.
I am delighted. I am so delighted. I can't come up with the word delighted.
Okay.
Well, join us next week for another episode of Promise Keepers.
Okay.
Oh, no.
So we're here today not to talk about the many iterations of the Broadway musical Annie, but with Annie about Akira Kurosawa's Shakespeare adaptation. Justin, this is the second week in a row where we've had a faithful...
Right.
I don't know. I can't do that bit. It's another Shakespeare adaptation, but this one's a real one, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and you know, interestingly, going back to Annie, a lot of people consider this like a spiritual sequel to that musical.
Annie, yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking while I was watching it.
Yes.
I was just waiting for Tim Curry to like pop out with a mustache
and a jazzy little tune. Yeah. That would have been something. That doesn't happen in this movie, but all the most important things that happen in Macbeth happen in this movie because it's an adaptation. So we're going to get to Throne of Blood. But before we do that, we're going to talk about what we watched this week. How about our guest? You go first. What did you watch this week, Annie?
All right, well, I watched a movie that I've been meaning to watch for years and years, and one that I'm guessing that neither of you have seen or would like. a 2009 film called Atonement. Now, I know Travis hasn't seen it, but Justin, did you ever see Atonement?
I have not. Is that the one with James McAvoy?
Yes, so it's directed by Joe Wright from Ian McEwan's novel. Keira Knightley, James McAvoy, and Saoirse Ronan... was nominated for an Oscar at the age of like 12 or 13, at least when she made the movie. She was 12 or 13, so that's impressive. But
I like her. She's good in things.
Yes, and she was good in this.
Good
Wright,
commentary, Travis.
Thank
like
you.
That.
That's why they come to this show.
Joe Wright and Keira Knightley have made at least three movies together. This was the first one. Oh, no, this is the middle one. They had previously made Pride and Prejudice, and then they would later make Anna Karenina. And my first note that I made... in my head and then on paper about this movie was, this makes my eyes happy and my heart sad. like, it is gorgeous. This movie is so beautifully shot. And I think it won an Oscar for something along those lines, photography or cinematography or something like that. Just absolutely beautiful. But it is pure melodrama. Like, this is just all about the giant feelings. And I was trying to figure out what it was saying. And I think the name of the movie is Atonement. Like, you can't get much more between the eyes than that. And I just don't think it says anything very interesting about atonement. I think this thing, it was a big swing and they just whiffed it. And I'd almost rather have a movie that's not trying to say anything and doesn't say anything than something that thinks it's saying something brilliant, but actually falls flat on its face.
That is exactly what we said last week, Justin, about Forbidden Planet, isn't it? It's like, this movie is taking itself very seriously, and at the end of the day, you're left with nothing.
A bad Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, that's like 2 hours long.
So I was pretty sure you could pause this movie at any point and just get a beautiful print.
Yeah.
And so, I mean...
Yeah, it did win the Oscar for cinematography. And it was nominated... This, I was going to say, when you brought this up off mic, I was like, that was nominated for a bunch of Oscars. It like, lots. Like, picture... Shockingly, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Actress for Saoirse Ronan. Screenplay.
No.
You're wrong, actually. And I was wrong, too. Cinematography, it did not win. It won for score. Is it a good score? Probably.
Right? You're more likely to remember score than I am, and I'm the one who watched it.
And then art direction and costume.
Yeah. So, I mean, gorgeous film. Good music, apparently.
as far as other people are concerned. Oh, this person does all of those movies.
And the acting is strong. I think it's strong acting. I just think that it's not actually...
Screenplay.
I think there's a problem. And it may be in the original novel, which I haven't read. But, for anyone out there who just really wants a melodramatic moment, this will deliver all the feelings and lots of pretty pictures.
Okay, Justin, do you got anything like Atonement that you watched this week?
Well, this is not quite like Atonement in theme, but it is similar in at least one respect to Annie's commentary on that movie. I watched, for better and for worse, perhaps more of one than the other, Thor, Love, and Thunder.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Yes, we have a sick disease, Travis. We... both know we have a problem, and we don't do anything about it, except indulge in it more and more. So, Thor, Love, and Thunder, this is the second go-around that Taika Waititi's had with this property now, right? And I think you and I both enjoyed, to at least some degree, Thor Ragnarok, right? I mean, that's my recollection.
It was okay. It was fine.
It was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, this is... in my opinion, a little less okay, and that is because it's not anything to do really with the talent of anyone involved, including Taika Waititi. I mean, I think he is a funny guy, and clearly, I mean, we've seen some of the stuff that he has done. He really shot for the stars and landed that ship with Jojo Rabbit. But this tries to do some of the same things that Thor Ragnarok did, i.e., do some really zany, goofy comedy, and then weave in some kind of dramatic narrative that matters. And because I feel pretty sure neither of you are going to lynch me if I tell you plot details,
please,
for the sake of our brief discussion here, I'll
that's
just
what I was
going to
ask
that,
you. I just want to know what happens in this dumb movie, because like all I can tell from the trailer that I was assaulted by probably like 6 dozen times. I just saw it everywhere. It's like, okay, this looks like Ragnarok. That's what it looks like. So does anything happen in it that's like remotely interesting?
Yeah, and that's what kind of makes it disappointing, is that it does, the core of this idea is that Jane Foster, who is Natalie Portman's character, comes back for this movie, and she has been diagnosed with cancer, and as a part of her... alternative medicine journey, she goes to the remnants of Thor's hammer, and it calls to her and empowers her with the abilities of mighty Thor. And even though it does that, it does not cure her of cancer. In fact, she ends up dying in the movie, in as permanent a way as you can die in these kind of movies. You know, they show her going to Valhalla. So that in and of itself is kind of, if you just told me that detail, I would be a little bit interested and more excited to see, you know, how do we do that, especially if it's a story that has something about either atonement, if we're lucky, or redemption or sacrifice. But unfortunately, it's all so banal, sadly, that it doesn't really have a lot of meaning. And to back me up on this, I have my good friend Christian Bale.
He's
got to go. I'm sorry, he can't. He was going to be on. I guess he got. Okay, he's got a thing.
He's too busy screaming at a key grip somewhere for walking through the shot. That's
right. Isn't that a bummer? When you do, he's just going to be known for that probably forever.
Yeah.
So anyway, he did an interview a day or so ago, actually, with Variety, I think. Anyway, he said that working on this movie was the definition of monotony.
always a good sign.
I learned was not a compliment. and he chalked that up to a lot of, like, he has this story where, you know, it's all green screens, right? There's very little practical. There's very little actual sets. And so he was told by some person on the crew, hey, you got to get over to stage 3. And he was like looking at the screen behind him like, I thought I was supposed to be on the blue one. They're like, yeah, it is a blue one. Well, I'm here now. No, you're on stage 7. You need to go to 3. Just sounds like a unique circle of hell.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Like, so, what does it matter if there's blue behind you? I mean, there's probably 12 good answers to that question, but it's annoying that we even have to ask. That's the truth.
So yeah, he is one of the better parts of the movie, because even though he's clearly, you know, he's not doing his method thing, he's still just really fun to watch, you know. Chris Hemsworth
chewing scenery. He's the bad guy, right?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. No, he's doing everything you would want him to in that role. But yeah, it starts out kind of strong, for what it is, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't stick the landing and is worse off for it, unfortunately.
Cool.
So, what about you?
Still
Trav
batting
Man?
1,000 over there in the Marvel camp, it sounds like. I rewatched Coen's Ballad of Buster Scruggs. How do you feel about the Coens, Annie? You like them mostly or some? Or
I really like the Coens. Part of one of my many failings is that I haven't watched as many of them as I want to, and that is on my to-watch list. Feel free to spoil it, because let's be honest, it's been on the list for years,
I mean,
and I haven't gotten to it.
I don't think I need to spoil it. It's an anthology, so it's cool because there's six separate stories. But Justin, we watched this initially. I remember we both were like, it was fine. Like, there were good things and things that I feel like it aged really well, at least for me. When I rewatched it, I liked it more the second time than the first time. And maybe that's just because I feel like in the couple years since it's come out, the expectations for something that might come out directly to streaming versus something that gets a theatrical release, which I think that probably did get some sort of limited theatrical release, but this is a Netflix movie. And there are times when, like, compared to a regular Coen's theatrical release, which is like typically like a hermetically sealed, like, perfect product, like, they're just so well shot and edited and acted. And I've heard stories about the Coens, like, that are sort of like Neil Simon-esque, where like an actor will ask if they can move an article in the sentence from here to there, and they're like, no, you can't do that. So they have this, like, I don't know, somewhat Kubrickian like level of control over lots of those little details, and I think that makes for really tidy movies. And this is like, I feel like the Netflix budget shows a little bit here and there in the visuals, but I really liked it the second time. I thought that each story had something interesting to say and add, and the Tom Waits one, Justin, just kind of rules. It's so good. So I don't know. I would anybody who's a Coen's fan who hasn't seen it, check it out. And if you like anthology things, it's one of the few out there that I think is actually good from beginning to end. It's got a ton of really good actors in it. You know, like James Franco pops up in one, and who else, Justin? You know, you got Tim Blake Nelson, who's like one of the Coen's standard guys. And just like every one of them has a nice little hook and a good cast, and then they're over, which is kind of interesting. So that's good. Watch that. But Justin, you mentioned green screens and, you know, a lack of practical effects. I don't think we're going to have that issue with the movie we're talking about today, because all they had was places and people, and they just put a lot of cameras on different places, different people. And it's called Throne of Blood. So, we are coming off of, like I said, Justin, something that I don't know if it, as much as people do these days, claim it to be a Shakespeare adaptation. The people who made the movie, I think, were like, yeah, it's got some elements of The Tempest or whatever. But this one is a for sure adaptation of Shakespeare's Macbeth by a person named Akira Kurosawa, who, if you are any kind of a film nerd or film buff or whatever, have probably heard of or seen a bunch of his things. Justin, this is the first time I've watched Throne of Blood. Is this the first time you've seen it?
Yes, sir. First viewing.
Cool. And then you did you say you'd seen it before, but a long time ago?
Yeah? A long time ago. Many, many, many years ago. I took a grad school course called Shakespeare in Film.
There you
and
go.
So Kurosawa played heavy.
How many of his did you get in there? It would have been.
I think it was just this and Ron.
Okay. And we found the other one the other day, there's a third Shakespeare he did. I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, but it doesn't get nearly as much credit as these other two.
Yeah. So it is, in fact, like, I don't know. When we're talking about Shakespeare adaptations, I think there's a little bit of a distinction to be made between something that is trying to kind of beat for beat or moment for moment, like take the story and translate it to a different aesthetic or a different time or whatever. And then there's other ones that take more liberties or bigger liberties. And then on the end, somewhere just in like far, far off the cliff, you have something like Forbidden Planet that's like, oh, this is The Tempest. And you're like, well, there's a guy alone on an island. But other than that, not really.
Yeah, but you know what? We didn't give that movie enough credit for doing what Shakespeare always did, and that was bringing in a robot.
That's true. That's true. We
so
failed to
I feel like,
that.
You know what? We owe an apology to the listening public.
Yeah.
And the deaf and hard of hearing, too. I don't mean to exclude anyone. Oh, my goodness. I feel so bad.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Robots. Thank you, Shakespeare. And I feel like that's, as we're hopefully going to get into, Travis, I hope we dedicate maybe several episodes to this topic. I feel like that's one of Kurosawa's big failings in this movie.
I think we should just do a whole spinoff podcast about Shakespeare. It should just be called Shakespeare and Robots. And that would be for five people in the universe who would be interested.
Yeah, and I think Joel and Ethan Coen would be two of them. So
they'd be
time well spent in my book.
First episode, yeah. Okay, so as far as cast and crew and background goes, let's get through that stuff, and then we'll get into what's it saying, which is kind of...
And when you say get through that, does that... So I have IMD pulled up for the whole cast and crew.
Yeah.
Am I doing all of the cast, or are you reading all of the crew?
I don't want to read all of anything, if we can help it. Did you want to read
all
of it?
Okay, I'm really confused, because we had this whole pregame thing. You know, you're like, okay, you take M through Z on the cast, and then we'll switch it around for the crew.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, okay, A through L. You know, so here I am. I'm ready to go Akira, but... Now I don't know what you want from me. Can you tell me what you want?
Yeah, all I was gonna say, Justin, is that it's we've already talked about the director. There's a few credited writers, and I think the two names of note for us, because I'm not like some expert on Japanese film, are we have the same two leads that were in Stray Dog, which we've already covered. So Toshirô Mifune and Takashi Shimura. And I didn't even recognize Takashi Shimura until like the very end as the character he plays in the movie. So basically, somebody run down the gist of the story of Macbeth and give me the flyover version and use this movie's version of Macbeth.
All right. So off the top of my head, having watched the movie yesterday, honestly, the plot is pretty similar to the original, to Shakespeare. There's really not much difference in basic plot. So... I'm just going to use Shakespeare's names because otherwise my brain will explode.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to be very bad at pronouncing all of the Japanese names, but just forgive us people listening who care about such things. And we may just use the Shakespeare names.
Yeah. So Macbeth is a lord, and he's riding through the forest with one of his friends who's also a lord, and they run into some magic people or a singular magic person, depending on the version.
This one's singular.
This
magic
one's singular.
Person, yeah.
And they say to these two men, they say to Macbeth, you will first, you will be elevated in one way, and then eventually you'll become king. And then they look at his friend and they said, but your son, like, will be king. Or in other words, your descendants will become king. And that's a little confusing, because usually when you tell one man he's going to be king, you don't tell another man that. Anyway, it's confusing. And so they're like, whatever, these are just crazy people in the woods. But then those predictions start coming true, and Macbeth's wife, who is simply named Lady Macbeth, decides to push those predictions, and she convinces her husband to murder the king so that he can then become the king. And he does. And then they both feel really bad about it.
They're bummed.
They're so bummed. Yeah. But then Macbeth starts getting worried about his friend's son taking the throne away from him. And so he orders the friend and the son to be killed. The friend is killed. The son escapes. And then Macduff comes out of the woods. And then there's a prophecy that says, no man born of woman will unseat you. And Macbeth goes, sweet. And then they're like, Macduff's like, surprise, I was born by cesarean section.
Bam.
You're dead.
Okay, so.
Got him. That classic C-section twist. Man, gets me every time.
I had a nickel for every C-section twist. Okay, I have a question about the adaptation stuff, because it kind of will play into how we talk about the third act of this movie, I think. And then because the story is, you know, old and familiar, and you can go read Macbeth if you want to, I don't feel like going platform for platform is going to make our night any more fun or our listeners.
What are we? Okay, Travis, so we're not reading all the names of the cast and crew. We're not going plot point by plot point.
What are we even doing? It may be next? Justin, that we're trying to make a podcast that people actually want to listen to and are entertained by. That might be the goal.
I don't think that's it.
Oh,
I don't think that's it. Okay.
Why start now?
My question is, in the original version versus this version, does the forest moving thing, is that the replacement for the, is that in the original?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, because that's the other part of the prediction is,
okay,
is no man born of woman will dethrone you. And you will not fall from your throne until the forest comes to the castle.
Okay, so that's what I was asking. But the C-section thing's not in the movie.
No, I guess it isn't.
It isn't.
You're right.
They cut that bit. So that's why I was wondering if it was like they used the forest imagery to sort of be the like twist.
The C-section.
The forest is the C-section, yes.
Yeah.
No, they're both in the original Shakespeare, okay. And I
conflated the two.
Didn't notice that the C-section wasn't in the movie.
Okay, there's no diplomatic way to say I didn't notice something. Okay, so that's the background. Okay, any historical backdrop that you guys want to lay here for? I mean, this is obviously not a Cold War story, but it's definitely like in the same, you know, date range as all the other movies from this series. So is there anything from history that plays into this adaptation and how we might kind of interpret it or take it in?
For me, nothing like that stuck out to me, okay, because I feel like Kurosawa is really trying to pay maybe a lot of homage or really do a very faithful kind of Japanese version of Macbeth.
Yeah.
Just planting the time period in England to the time period in Japan. So,
well, Justin, before someone comes to take you out, Scotland.
Oh, that's right. Macduff, beware Macduff. You know, in Justin's family history, which is just as interesting as the rest of the world's.
Yeah. I would argue more interesting based on a couple of the anecdotes that I've heard about your uncle.
Wait, yeah. Are we going to find out we're related, Justin?
That would be weird. Yeah,
that's the twist. I was born in a C-section. my wife had this great idea that we were going to get a Scottish deerhound, and then we were going to, instead of beware of dog, we were going to put that sign up, and it was going to say beware Macduff.
That's pretty good.
So yeah, that's pretty good. That will be for the one person out there that is listening.
They'll go, ha, Shakespeare. Yeah. Be great.
Okay, speaking of that laugh, there's a lot of laughing in this movie from Mr. Mifune. He laughs like I laugh on the podcast, Travis. It's like, I guess he's feeling it, but I don't believe him.
To every chuckle and yuck, Justin. But I think, did you have anything that you wanted to throw in for history?
I thought the history part was actually the most interesting thing to think about was that this movie is what it's produced in 1957. And so we're just 12 years after the end of the war, and yet we're making a war movie. But then the U.S. military, the Marines, were actually helping them build this set.
Yeah, because they were stationed there, right?
Because they were stationed there. It's on the most of it was filmed on Mount Fuji. And so you have Kurosawa is looking to the West. He's pulling inspiration from the West. He's being assisted by Westerners in making the film. And yet it's about feudal Japan and the Japanese military and honor and military glory and military failure. And I just thought that in a post-World War II Japan, there has to be some really complicated messaging going on there. And so anyway, I just thought that was really interesting to think through not just what this movie says to us in America in 2022, mm-hmm. but what this movie was saying
to a Japanese audience.
To a Japanese audience in 57.
I agree. I did not think of any of those things, but that's why we have you on. let's get to the big question, which is, what's it saying? Okay, so assuming if you're going through the effort to know Macbeth a little bit or have watched a couple adaptations maybe or watched this on its own, let's set aside, again, plot point for plot point and just talk about, what does this movie feel like to watch? How does it work as an adaptation? Because, again, like, there's a lot of different ways to adapt Shakespeare. And then, like, what worked, what didn't work, and what's the thrust of the story? I just want to start off by saying, this movie has a lot of horsies. Lots and lots of horsies. I think I wrote down 6 times that if you don't like horses, you're not going to be into this movie because they're all over the place. And like, I get it. Like, it's how you got around in feudal Japan. I'm just saying that they take the time in the edit room to show us a lot of horses galloping around. And that's kind of how the movie starts. Starts with people, you know, riding around talking about this apparently important essential battle that's been won, and it's going to move things around as far as who controls which fortress. And then we do end up in the forest with what would be called the witch is mm-hmm. in the Macbeth, the OG Macbeth. but in this case they just call her a spirit, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a weird androgynous like person with a really horrifying voice, I think. Justin, how do you take that sequence, which sort of is like the whole beginning bit, into the prophecy? Like, what were you feeling at this point in the movie?
Well, before we get to that, you said something really offensive, and I feel like it's my solemn duty to call you out on that.
Uh-huh.
They don't like being called horsies. Horse and rider together.
I'll bleep that. For
equestrianism.
For the I'll bleep
so,
that.
So, you know what, Trev? I mean, you so derailed me, with that. I was feeling
okay.
Pretty sad. So,
how do you like the way they do? Cause you've seen or read or something, some other mm-hmm. Macbeth version before. So what do you think about this compared to some other version of this scene, right? The Macbeth and Macduff.
And the witchy witch.
Right?
Banquo. It's Macbeth and Banquo.
There you go. Those two. See, I'm thinking of the Japanese names, which are Miki and Washizu.
Washizu and Mizi.
Mizi?
I'm saying it wrong. Miki. Just trust
Miki,
that
like the mouse, sort of.
I wrote it
Miki?
Wrong.
Like he's meek?
Anyway.
Miki.
Okay, Justin, go.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, so I'm sorry. Are we just talking about the witchy witch?
Whatever scene? You want. It's your show.
Great. No, it's your show. You can have it. No. No, I thought that it was a good... again, Kurosawa, he really is trying to do an honest take, I think. He's really trying to take Shakespeare's work and just he's plugging it in to somewhere in feudal Japan. And so I feel like that is reflected even in how this evil spirit is portrayed. Where instead of having this very obvious, at least in Shakespeare's play, you know, it's like, hey, here's some witches that want to tell you something. And as the audience, right, or the reader, you go, okay, well, duh, it's probably not, like, good. I'm not just going to listen to this person and think it's going to turn out well. But in the androgynous witch woman or whatever with the lovely singing voice that she has, I feel like that is played in a culturally, maybe there's some more nuance there, probably a lot of which I'm not even aware of, because I know you guys thought otherwise. I didn't actually grow up in Japan.
Right.
I did not. And so I appreciated how they, their even their interaction with the spirit is a little more like on the same plane, where they're like, hey, the spirit's trying to keep us here. Let's just use our arrows and my spear and we're just going to get out of here. It's like, well, it's not the way we usually interact with witches in the West.
Yeah.
At least last time I interacted with a witch in the West, let me tell you, I had a baseball bat and it ended up getting used against me. So you just want to be careful when you're out there dealing with the witches.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I thought it was interesting, too, that the witch has more of a, I don't know. You guys tell me if you feel differently when you compare this to Macbeth. But in Macbeth, I get there's a really interesting undercurrent, I feel like, when the witches pronounce their prophecies, where it's like they have some motive for doing this that is evil. And I don't get any of that in this version. I just get that the spirit who, you know, there's a couple lines of dialogue that clearly make it abundantly clear that the spirit is very disenfranchised, doesn't really understand humanity, but for some reason is interacting with humanity. But it's not really in a malevolent way. I guess you could argue against that with the second time that that the Lord Washizu interacts with the witch, but it's just this kind of like, well, I'm just a spirit. This is what I do. It's more of a perfunctory thing than some
like
kind
a
of
messenger or like, yeah, something like that.
So I know Travis saw this movie. Justin, did you see Joel Cohen's version of Macbeth with Denzel Washington that came out last year?
No, I have not seen that yet, guys.
Well, the witch in that movie is, at least for me, the most memorable part of the movie.
It's so freaking cool.
The whole movie is amazing. Did we see that together?
Yeah, yeah, okay. We saw it together. It's cool. One actress who plays three. Well, they depict her as more than one witch, but it's one actress doing all the work, and she's really interesting.
Yeah,
like, physically and stuff.
And anyway, I can't verbally explain the coolness of that performance. And didn't she win some? She won some awards for that performance.
I'll double check that.
But Justin, I think what you said about kind of the more traditional, original versions of this story, there being a lot of malevolence there, I think that's accurate. I took I and a couple other teachers took a bunch of students up to a Shakespeare festival for a few days a couple weeks ago, and we were talking to one of the professionals who works up there, and she said, you know, of course she wouldn't name this play and only referred to it as the Scottish play, and then she was explaining that, you know, how it's cursed and all these things, and then the kids were all looking at me like, why is this lady so weird? I'm like, just be polite. And but one thing she said to them was that there's a tradition in the theater that the curses or the spells or whatever that the witches pronounce are like actual.
Yeah, yeah.
They're real.
For
and
real.
That's why there's so much bad juju around this play. But yeah, whereas in Kurosawa's version, there's no malevolence there. It's just a spirit in the woods speaking truth or something.
It's weird though, right? Like, I don't know. Again, Justin, you mentioned like, missing some cultural cues, and like that's going to be part of our conversation, right? Because like three white people talking about one of the most Japanese things that's ever existed, and so I think it's fair to like leave room for that, like leave a little like, I don't think I quite get this, but I can still appreciate, you know what I mean? And so part of that weirdness is like they come upon the spirit in the woods, and she is like winding thread from her own hair, maybe.
Well, that was a the fact that there were three witches in the original was an homage back to like the three muses and in Greek whatever.
Yeah,
and but also they would spin. They were known for being weavers and spinners of string. And so when Kurosawa was like, "Nah, I'm going down to one." Like,
got to spin though.
Got to like the spin spinning.
Yeah.
Spinning wheel.
And
was
you guys
a...
think they provide for themselves? They're at the farmer's market every week, just like everyone.
Would you
else.
Like some of my hair thread? It's very cheap.
Yeah. It's usually like armbands and tube socks.
Yeah.
That I found.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the voice is cool and creepy. The minute she started talking, I was like, ugh. Like, I think that was pretty effective. And like I think overall, you probably would both agree that like this movie, like I'll just be perfectly frank. Shakespeare, a lot of the time, doesn't like emotionally connect for me. I appreciate the mastery over the language and the, you know, the amazing archetypes that it creates for storytelling, like going forward in history. But like, I'm like watching it again, like I'm looking at this movie like I look at a lot of kind of more one-to-one Shakespeare adaptations, and it kind of feels like looking at a well-designed, well-constructed piece of like brutalist architecture made out of like concrete with like 90 degree angles and windows in the right places. And it's like, this is all functional and it actually looks pretty cool, but like it doesn't make me feel very much. So the one time that I feel like it succeeded here and there was like, it gets kind of gnarly, I think, when it should. And part of that is the creepiness with the witch's voice, and part of it's some of the violence later on that I think is really effective. But a lot of it feels, Justin, like maybe too patient, you know, like in the edit or in the pacing or whatever, to like keep you grounded in the actual like whole character. You know what I mean? It's like you're supposed to be watching all these spaces and how the people interact with the spaces. And there's a lot of emphasis on faces. I don't mean to sound like I'm doing spoken word poetry, but like there's, you know, there's a couple different aesthetics in Japanese theater. You guys already mentioned kabuki, I think, off mic, and that's one of them. But like traditionally, kabuki is painted faces and like crazy expressions. And I know for a fact from listening to an interview, Kurosawa, that he was pulling from the No tradition, which is NOH. That was all about masks. And so a lot of the characters in this are modeled after traditional No theater masks, including our Macbeth and our Lady Macbeth and a couple other characters. So some of that is like, I see it and I appreciate it and it's really well done. But it that alongside the fact that like I think the story is more concerned with this adaptation, rather, is more concerned with like how do we adapt these things for this time period, this aesthetic, and do it beautifully than it is with like, I don't know, no two characters in a scene ever really feel like they're like gonna die for each other. You know what I mean? Things happen, but like, I don't know.
Yeah. I think it changes. Like, I guess when I was watching the film, I felt like that's how it started.
Okay.
But that by the end there was some more real emotion and real reaction, and
yeah,
it was much more affecting, and that was part of the dissolving,
the descent,
yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. That he goes from being, and Lady Macbeth, that both of them go from being these very stylized, perfected, characters to just absolutely falling apart,
broken people.
Yeah. And that they're much more emotional and much easier to connect with as humans at the end than that stylized version at the beginning. But that may be true.
Because I think the stuff that I actually connected to more is probably in the back half, not in the front half. Because Justin, don't you think this is like you cannot watch this movie if you are not ready to sit down and watch one, a Kurosawa, two, something very patient and deliberate. And the fact that like, I don't know about you, but we just came off of Singing in the Rain and Forbidden Planet, and then going back to black and white, and this being the black and white we go back to feels really like, using the blacks and grays and whites for, you know, a specific sparse like telling of the story. You know what I mean? If this was in color, like Ron is, I think it would feel way different, way, way different. The fact that this is in black and white makes it feel more deliberate.
Yeah. Well, and I think there is, because we want to try to be objective and, you know, talk about what this movie is saying. To me, Kurosawa continually communicates that he reveres Shakespeare and wants to, I think what he does right, especially in these scenes, which there are quite a few of, where nothing is being said, and there is just this sort of almost like a, I wouldn't say nightmarish, that's too strong of a word, but it's not a good dream. It's some kind of dreamscape where there's just fog and you're not quite sure where you are.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it does communicate a very similar vibe to what at least is in my mind's eye when I read Macbeth or when I see it performed, of that same kind of, here we are in the Highlands, and there is this sort of ominous, even the elements are somehow against us. Even, even God or even nature is preventing us from seeing things that, you know, would perhaps allow us to make better decisions. And then as far as you made a comment, Travis, about it not being very effective, emotionally, that you didn't resonate with it. I think that's totally fair, but I think it's also that we are, good heavens, coming up on 400 years away from the source material.
Mm-hmm.
So while it's wonderful, and I do not want to be on the train of academics that want to like get rid of teaching Shakespeare in higher education, I think there's a reason Shakespeare's been around for so long. Excuse me. But there is something to be said for if you continue to remove yourself from just a person that wrote something in history in some time, you have to do more legwork to get into, like, I'll be perfectly honest with you. The first time, if I just read through Shakespeare, no notes, no commentaries, no adaptations, I'm just going to go read through Shakespeare, I'm going to be a little lost because there's a good part of the vernacular that is not in use anymore. And it's just it's an intensely poetic way of expressing oneself that is beautiful and tight. You talk about hermeneutically sealed with the Coen brothers. I mean, Shakespeare's a bank vault, but it takes a lot of work to process. And no small part of that is because we're so far away. There was an interview that Ian McKellen did back in the day with Mr. Dick Cavett on the latter's show, and Dick asked him about the difference between stage and film acting. And anyway, I related to this discussion, one of the points that Ian McKellen made is that people are just, they're moved by different things now than they used to be even a couple of generations ago, right? And so this interview is from the 1970s that I'm talking about. And so he's talking about folks in the early 1900s that would be more moved by something like, you know, Shakespeare, the bells, right? That it's just, there's a different way of apprehending art, I think. There is a different expectation in each generation of how to be moved. And I think that because Kurosawa is definitely going for tradition, whether that's Shakespeare or whether that's no theater or kabuki or whatever, he is leaning all the way into that. He's not working to try to make it relevant for today's audience. I don't think he's purposely working against relevance, but he is working towards reverence, in my mind. And so that leads to a very specific style, which in my opinion is not always in the movie's favor, right? If this is just going to stand alone as a movie, to me it's not as interesting to watch 2 minutes of just fog, no actors, no nothing. I'm just seeing fog and I'm waiting for something to happen. I understand. I understand what he's trying to communicate, but there's several instances of that kind of happening throughout this movie. And instead of it helping to reinforce an ominous tone or be like a drone in the background, to me, it becomes taxing as a film viewer because it's the wrong medium, in my opinion, for Kurosawa to try that. And I think there's a reason we don't see that in a lot of other Kurosawa stuff, because in my opinion, at least, it's just too much.
Okay. How about some stuff that we liked? What sequences, what moments, shots, whatever, kind of from the whole bulk of the story did you think worked particularly well, if there are any? I have
one. I love the scene. Did you just say Annie?
No.
Did you do that? Okay.
I pointed at her, but you can't see me pointing, so. Fine.
Get another curse by another witch with a baseball bat. So I really loved the scene where Miki and Washizu are being honored by their lord in the beginning, and you just follow them up. The camera puts you right in their hemisphere, and they walk between all the flaming torches and all the other soldiers. There's so much in Kurosawa that is still being used and aped today.
Oh, yeah.
And I just would love to, I mean, how exciting would it be? And you know, I just said things that weren't overly congratulatory for this movie, but I want to congratulate it where I can. And I feel like how exciting would it be in 1957 to sit down in a theater and see some shots like this?
Yeah.
You know, Travis, like we talked about a season or so ago for A Matter of Life and Death.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, some of that stuff is just like, what the heck? No one's even done that since then. Or, you know, it would be 80 years before anyone tried that shot again. So I feel a similar kind of excitement seeing some of the shots like that in this movie.
Yeah, the scope is great. I mean, like, I have a note somewhere that says, like, tons of people are better than CGI every time. It's the difference between the Hobbit movies and the original Lord of the Rings movies. Like, you can just tell that, not that they had an option back then. I'm just like, just look at this footage of, like, this giant group of people coming over a hill on horseback or whatever. Or when that long shot near the end where they're winding through, you know, kind of coming toward the castle. It's like, this... Yeah. Always looks better than some green screen catastrophe. Annie, what about you? What would you like?
Well, I already mentioned the Coen movie that came out last year. And I was watching this and I was just thinking this absolutely had to be such a major influence on Joel Coen when he made his film.
You can definitely
he chose to do it in black and white.
Yep.
It's a brutalist style.
It's not widescreen, right? It's the other one, 4:3 or whatever.
Yeah.
The aspect ratio.
I did a quick search to try to find anything on that. And there was just like one sentence in one interview where he was like,
I like Throne of Blood.
I watched Throne of Blood a lot. Yeah. I was like, more? But that was
you
all
can
I got.
See it. The fog especially.
Yeah.
Right? Like the opening sequence. I mean, I'm sure there's fog in a lot of stage versions of this as well. I'm just saying like the choice to hold on the fog and have them like appear out of things are always going away from camera or toward camera in the fog. And I feel like that does happen a few times in the Coen too.
So I really liked that. I kind of forgot what your question was. Oh, I want to go back. Forgive me, Justin. I want to go back to the horsies.
Yes, the horsies.
I was noticed also that there are
a great number
of equines in this film. But what I was so impressed with was that the actors were such good horsemen. Like they had such good control. And there's one scene that's actually pretty close up. I think it's on the Macbeth character. And he just has that horse like
back and forth,
circling and circling and circling. And he has to get the horse to do just the right movements and just the right time to keep him in frame and to keep that idea of swirling. And and he's doing that while also acting and everything else he has to do. And
in a costume that probably weighs 100 pounds.
Yeah. And I was just watching this man's horsemanship on top of everything else he's doing.
Horsemanship, 5 stars.
And I was just so impressed. So,
what a nightmare it must be to get the right shot with a freaking horse involved. You know what I mean? Even a trained horse, like it must be horrible.
Yeah.
Mr. Ed never had a problem. I don't know.
Wasn't he mostly in a stall?
He was one take every time, baby. And then back to his trailer to smoke a pack of cigarettes.
I just think that again, 1957 Japan is so far away from us here and now. But I just think that having gone through everything the Japanese had gone through and all the suffering they had gone through, as most of the world had been suffering at the same time through World War II, to go to see a movie that in some ways is celebrating the military traditions of Japan, but doing it in feudal Japan, so it's, you know, a little distinct from what they've just been through. But I just wonder, as a Japanese person sitting in a theater in 1957, maybe even as a veteran,
how that hit,
or a relative of a veteran, like, what did it feel like to see the I don't want to say the glory, but maybe I mean that.
But
like,
it's both, right? There's some glorification and some here's the downfall of a prideful person who
And it's also about the downfall of someone who had no honor you know, it's also about all of that, but there's still all of the imagery of the warrior and the glorification of the warrior. And I don't have a conclusion. I cannot land this plane.
It's a good question.
But I just think that it might have been really meaningful and important to its original intended audience on that level.
I think I'm not a Japanese person from 1957, but I agree. It's an interesting question, and I don't have the answer. I wonder if you both were struck by this sequence when there's that one kind of sort. These rooms are just empty. One of the things that I think is interesting about the look of this movie is like there's no furniture anywhere. So like no set is crowded. It's just like when he goes wide on a room, It's just an empty room with a person sitting on the floor. Oh,
can I talk about something that neither of you probably know or care about?
Please.
All right. So a few years ago in like popular home furnishing, home design, there was like the Scandi influence, like the Scandinavian influence.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, right? Well, now they've added like Japanese influence to the Scandinavian influence and they call it Japandi.
Ew.
Which I'm not a fan of. I don't like that word.
Scandinese? Yes, that sounds worse.
But I don't know. But I was, it sounds so bad. I was watching this movie and I was just like getting inspiration. Not, my house will never be minimalist. But I was just thinking about how current it looked.
Oh,
like
yeah,
so
yeah.
much of the design looked like what you can, you know,
yeah.
what is being it's offered like in home design
IKEA's
today.
IKEA's thing next year will be full of this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, it didn't, to me, it did not look old. It looked very current.
Yeah. So one of the sequences that takes place in that one of those, like it's essentially his throne room, right? But there's no real throne and his crown of sorts, which is this really interesting looking like headpiece with a big crescent like moon on it, just sits on a table. And this guard comes in. Forgive me. One of you can probably fill in the blanks here because there's a lot of guards running and screaming things in this movie and then sometimes living and sometimes not living. But there's one point where a guard runs in and he's telling him something really important. Can't remember which bullet point it is. And he kills him right off. What does he say? What does he tell? What does the guard
tell? Well, they were supposed to kill the equivalent, the name I got wrong last time and you mocked me for it.
Yeah,
Miki.
Yeah.
They were Miki. Supposed to kill him and his son.
And they didn't kill the son.
And they didn't
the
kill
son
the
got
son.
Away.
The
That's
son
what
Miki Jr.
Miki Mouse the second.
I forgot to kill Jr., sir. I'm sorry.
Okay. When he's, there's, that part I thought was amazing and gross. So gross. Like if you're listening to it with headphones or if you have it turned up on a decent sound system, the shot is beautiful. It's like a big wide shot of him standing over the guy when he stabs him. So you don't see the sword going in because it's 1957 and like most of the time you're not going to see that kind of thing. But you do, Justin, see like blood pouring out onto the ground in front of him and it's black and white. So it's kind of mixed right. in. But if you look for it, it's like a pool. It's pretty gnarly. And the grossest thing about this is the sound of his hands going like slapping in the puddle of blood. And he's kind of gurgling. Like I was watching that like, whoa, this like for a really patient, slow, quiet movie until it's not quiet. Cause like Justin said, it's like, it's quiet. And then it's like very loud and expressive, you know, like mm-hmm. that's sort of the style. Right. And that's somewhat cultural, somewhat time period, correct. It's just all those things mixed up. But I thought that moment was like, whoa, I don't know if that knocked you back on your heels, Justin.
Yeah, no, I really appreciated that. The movie takes, I would say for my money, Just my read on this movie is that it's really, it serves to be an adaptation of Shakespeare. So any kind of warrior imagery or anything, to me, I don't get any glorification vibes. I mean, I feel like you could make a good argument for that in a lot of this guy's other work, even like Seven Samurai or Yojimbo. But to me, I don't see that personally here. And that's really driven home by just the kind of, the horrificness of when murder or killing in general is depicted. There's nothing cool about it, including when that poor dude is writhing on the ground trying to cling to life and dying, or when Mifune's Macbeth / Washizu is killed at the end. I mean, there's
yeah,
nothing...
we got to talk about the arrow sequence because it's ridiculously cool. It's so cool.
Yeah, and even though he's a totally wicked guy, I mean, it's still like there's nothing like that great about seeing somebody running, just clinging for life while they're being killed slowly. And so for me, I think that's one another strength of the movie is that showing that all this greed, all the wrongly directed ambition of people, it doesn't result in anything good. And as long as we keep having problems in the world, I don't think that's a point that can be driven home more often than it needs to be. And I think this movie does a good job of giving us a stark and kind of bloody, albeit in black and white, depiction of why we should aspire to greater things.
So I think off mic, I told Travis that the most boring thing we could do would be to just talk about all the ways that the movie is the same or different than the original Shakespeare.
But now you're going to do
but
it.
But now I'm going to do it. because I think, and I may have misunderstood, but in the original Shakespeare, and I said this earlier, Macbeth is killed by Macduff who comes out of the woods. And in this version, you still have the soldiers in the woods coming to attack the castle and carrying all the trees.
I love
how
that.
How many trees did they cut down for that scene?
I love that so much.
It was beautiful.
Like, I know the plot point, right?
Right.
Like, but the reveal of it in a cinematic way is so freaking good because the way they show that Forrest moving forward from his perspective, it just looks like he's losing it or like he's like getting his comeuppance. Mm-hmm. And then when they do that shot from the side of the trees moving and then you see the people carrying the trees, I was like, this is the coolest thing.
Yeah.
Like,
but, okay, correct me if I'm wrong. He doesn't get killed by the people with the trees. He gets killed by his own men inside.
I think that's right, Justin. Do you
know? In this movie?
In this movie. Yeah. And I think that's such an interesting
switch. They show them coming toward the castle, but they don't bust down the gate and fire arrows at him. His people turn on him.
His own men are like, we're not going to go to war for you. We're not going to die for you. We're going to kill you so that we can throw your body over the wall. And then these people coming to attack us will go away.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, that is such a radically different message that this man is... He is murdered by his own people who won't put up with his, you know, murderously bad behavior.
It's right after the speech too, right? Like he gives the big, like kind of rousing, do you trust me? Will you fight with me?
No.
Yeah. Well, they raise their spears. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as they see the forest is moving, they're like, nope. I think it's an interesting choice. Do you have anything on that, Justin?
Ilya, if you wanted to, you know, write a college paper about it or something, I think you could make an argument that if there is some social commentary there, then that's a very deliberate choice by Kurosawa not to follow the script, maybe for the benefit of his audience in 57, at least the more immediate audience in Japan, because here you've been through a little-known event in world history called the Second World War, and resulted in millions and millions of people around the world, we all know that, being killed. But so much of what Japan went through was because there was this, you know, the emperor was worshipped in some senses, literal and figuratively. And it was very important that, you know, losing face is a big thing in Japanese culture, and the emperor's not going to lose face. So we absolutely cannot surrender. It's all about the emperor, right? And this movie really flips that kind of authority structure on its head, where it's very clear we have a very Japanese understanding of deference, of respect, of a pecking order, right, and of authority. But when it comes down to brass tacks and these men realize we are all going to get killed just because this guy is so murderous and he's so evil, why don't we depose this tyrant and see what happens? And so I feel like if anything in this movie approaches shocking, it would be that decision to change that, because to me that would, I don't know, like you, Travis, didn't grow up in 1950s Japan, but I would think like, whoa, that is radically not how we, you know, I think as Westerners, that is a lot more common in our history, and for better or for worse, and it doesn't appear that shocking. I'd be really interested to go back in time and see if that had any effect, and if the message there was, hey, if you've got a not just a bad leader, but if you've got someone that is leading people to literal slaughter, then it is your civic duty to remove that person. I don't know if the movie was shooting for the stars in that way, but I think you could make an argument.
And that leads to them removing him from his position by firing about 1,000 arrows at him. Can we please touch on the, just like story-wise, Justin, I think you're right. I think the way he chooses to utilize the most violent moments are in they're running from trying to glorify violence in any way by making them kind of harrowing and really kind of graphic, especially for the time. But talk to me about the arrow sequence. These are my three notes. I think, Annie, you have some sort of similar notes, but like I was, you know, oscillating between appreciating the beauty of this movie and finding it a little slow at times. And then when we got to the last, I don't know, maybe 25 minutes, I was glued. Like I thought it was really, this movie knows how to end. I feel like that's one thing it gets absolutely right. And the arrow sequence is amazing. They used real arrows. And I think they only did it once.
Well, real arrows, but on
a string,
on strings, on wires. So they're actually being shot, but
yeah. But like imagine how many things could possibly go wrong, right? One of those wires breaks or is a little off, or he takes one step to the left and not to the right. And so, first of all, you can't see, like, I'm looking at an HD, you know, Criterion or whatever, like, rendering of this, Justin, on HBO Max, and I can't see any of those, like, tricks or anything. It just looks amazing. It's like all medium shots of him going left and right, and there's just like a dozen arrows smacking the wall and then going into him. And the little cherry on the cake, and my notes look like this. They say the arrow sequence is amazing. There's so many. And then through the neck, because I did not expect that from 1957. And it looks so good. I don't know if it's quick cuts or... I mean, yeah, no, I know it's an arrow on either side. And I'm just saying in the edit, I don't know how they got it to look so smooth. Because
really?
Like
the cut was really obvious.
No, I didn't think it was. I didn't think it was.
I was watching the same version you were watching. Justin, what did you think?
Well, I thought there was a dead giveaway, Travis, when they had that little, like, you know, there's like that quick 2 or 3 second shot of the grip's hands that are putting the arrow up in his neck. And then they like kind of slowly descend. To me, that was my giveaway. That's how I noticed.
Okay, cool. You want to talk about the arrow sequence for a minute, Justin?
No, it's great, man. It's harrowing is the right word. And I think that it rushes up against the reality that even if that's the right thing to do in a situation like that, it doesn't make it like, yay, we can all be happy now. This is wonderful. It's still taking life is not a pleasure. And it's just a sad reality of our crumbling existence here. So I enjoyed it as not because there was anything, you know, voyeuristically fun about that scene, but technically, like you're talking about, I heard about the real arrows thing too, and I thought it was really impressive that he took a real arrow through the neck.
That was just so cool.
He was like, hey, and Kurosawa was like, let's cut, and he's like, no, when life hands you lemons, stick an arrow in your neck and drink my blood. I think we're off the rails tonight. What's happened?
I don't know.
Is it the heat?
We're fine.
The only major topic I have left in my notes is about Lady Macbeth.
Yes. No, can we do that, Annie? Because I've never seen a portrayal of Lady Macbeth quite like this before.
So tell me, what do you mean you've never seen it quite like this before?
Well, and so again, some of that is probably cultural, right? Different expectations for a nobleman's wife in feudal Japan than of a noble woman in the West during the Middle Ages. But And so it's hard for me to tell how much of this is that character trying to fit into a cultural mode and or role, and how much of that, how much of this one note sort of lack of inflection and affectation is due to this idea that this character is very deliberate, very cunning, has sort of a singular purpose and vision for achieving things at the expense of displaying any humanity. So I didn't find it. I don't know that it bothered me, but it was just interesting to see it's not lifeless. I don't want to say that because it's really not. I think there really is a lot going on in that performance, but it's a lot of the same, it's a lot of the same thing going on, but.
I think there's two pieces that are coming together in what you're saying. And the first one is what Travis already mentioned, which is the influence of no theater and the fact that she's representing a very specific stylized caricature and face and mask that was very common and that is probably outside of our experience and familiarity. But the other piece of it is that every production of Macbeth has to figure out to what extent did Lady Macbeth inspire Macbeth to do the murder? And some productions have Macbeth just being a hapless fool and she has all of the agency and it's all her plan. And then other productions, you know, he's just like, he has it all in him, but, you know, she just kind of, you know, pushes him right over the line to do what he wanted to do in the first place. And so I just think this production chooses to really give her a lot of the agency of the, what, I don't know what you would call it, but just this desire for power, that so much of that is coming from her. And they made that. And I've seen that done in Western productions too. I don't think that's unique to this Japanese production, but they really make it clear that this is her plan to get power for them as a couple. And she is pushing him the whole way to.
It's one of those. Yeah. It's not like, I would say even in the Joel Cohen one, right? It's a little more hand in hand. Mm-hmm. The Denzel and Frances mm-hmm. McDormand dynamic there is more like he wants it more mm-hmm. obviously, and she kind of pushes him over the last step mm-hmm. is the feeling you get. Mm-hmm. I also think her descent into madness or whatever mm-hmm. is very compact feeling in this mm-hmm. adaptation, and like at least in that one, but I'm sure in other theatrical adaptations she mm-hmm. just probably gets more stage time than she does in this movie, right?
Well, and I think I said to you earlier, I think they messed with the plot, or messed with, just changed the plot a little bit, because they have her like whole
blood on the hands
out damn spot scene as a ghost, not after she has died, rather than before she has died. And I believe in the original Shakespeare that scene takes place before she's dead and they don't bring her back as a ghost.
Yeah. That's my recollection too.
And so they change that around, which might be leading towards your sense of it being compact.
And I think that's a no theater decision too, because mm-hmm. one of the tropes in no theater is you have a character in the story and it's very ambiguous as to whether or not they are dead or alive, or whether they're a spirit or a mm-hmm. person. And so mm-hmm. I think that's some of that carryover is like making it more on the line, mm-hmm. like, because you never do watch her die in this. Hear that she's close and that she's had the child, but it was stillborn, and you know, like all mm-hmm. that stuff. Is that her that has the, she doesn't mm-hmm. have, yeah, it is. Okay. I'm making sure. Cause like they never pan over to who that is, but
it was the horse.
It was the horse. It was the horsey. The horsey didn't make it. That's okay. They had a lot of spares. Okay, folks, let's get to the finish line here. Okay, Justin, is it worth your time, and how often would you rewatch it for Throne of Blood?
It's worth your time if you are an avid Kurosawa fan, or just some kind of film completist, or a Shakespeare head. I don't know. What do you call a super Shakespeare fan? Shakespeareo.
Nerd.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Nerd.
Some kind of.
Yeah. So, I think those are the people who are going to appreciate this most now. So if you're not one of those people, I don't know that there would be a really great reason for you to watch this. There's other wonderful adaptations, and you could just go see it as a play too, or read it. How many times would I probably wouldn't, this would not, I am not opposed to rewatching this, but I do not know that I would seek it out to do it, again. And that's for the reasons we've already discussed. So I won't belabor those anymore.
Well, rather than just repeating everything that Justin just said,
I think you should repeat everything Justin just said. And we should still read the entire cast list and cast and crew. We should do all
because I agree with everything.
Every horse's name, one after another.
I agree with everything Justin just said. So instead, I will add my favorite detail that we haven't said yet, which is that Throne of Blood is its English title. Yeah. But in Japanese, the Japanese title is Castle of the Spider's Web.
Pretty cool.
And I think that is a much better title.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, Throne of Blood is good. I get it. It makes sense.
Yeah.
But Castle of the Spider's Web, that is much better for this production.
And you agree with the other things he said, like words.
All of it.
All of it. Yeah.
All of it.
I'm on the same wavelength as you guys. I think like you can't look at I think the Brutus architecture is the image for me for this movie. It's like, yes, that is a beautiful, large, concrete construction. And I don't feel a lot for it or with it. And it's probably very fun. You know what I mean? Like everything is there that should be there for a good feudal Japan adaptation of this movie. It looks really pretty most of the time. But me and Annie were able to go see a stage adaptation of King Lear, which was just called Lear. And it was a modern language update of the story, and it was placed in with the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1960s. That was the setting, right? And so there were some aesthetic choices and lots of language choices to update the like you were talking about, Justin, how Shakespeare is his own genre, right? Like there's, it's not just old, it's also Shakespearean. And so the high poetry kind of thing, and the, he makes up words. I mean, like there's a lot of stuff in there that you would have to like figure out and do the work. A lot of that was gone in this adaptation. And at the same time, I feel, Annie, as though that kind of hit the bullseye for me as far as like, this is the same story with the same important, worthwhile elements, but there was not really any like squinting to understand what one person is saying to another. And both Shakespeare's voice, because there's lots of carryover Shakespeare in dialogue, and the person who adapted it, their voice were both, I feel like, equally present. And so, like you were talking about legwork, Justin, that's to me the sweet spot. The sweet spot is how can you tell this story and honor it, but also make it culturally relevant, like Shakespeare was doing when he wrote his plays, right? All these plays, some of the jokes and references and whatever don't work until you understand them. And even then you're like, oh, that's why it was funny to them. But you're not like, ha, 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 that's funny. I feel like that work kind of needs to be done at this point. And this is a hard one to attach to like that, because it is 70 years old at this point almost. And it is very Japanese. And so for me, I appreciate it. I think it's well made, but it's probably worth your time if you like are a film nerd, Kurosawa completist, Shakespeare completist, whatever, you know. But I'm not going to rewatch it because, like, I don't, it didn't make me feel many feelings. I like the ending bit though.
Mm-hmm. My supposition is that just like Lear, we really liked Lear because it was true to Shakespeare, but then it also was culturally relevant and had music and jokes and things that connected with our current culture. I would suspect that the original audience of this movie would have felt the same way about it, that it was connecting to their culture and their symbolism and all of that in a way that made it very accessible to them. We, as has been stated, are not from 1950s Japan.
That's what it'll be called, folks.
We are not from 1950s Japan. All right, well, thank you both for bringing your literary perspectives and brilliant commentary to a otherwise ignorant piece of work by me. Thanks for joining us, Annie.
Oh, you are too kind.
I think I'm just kind enough. Justin, we have Invasion of the Body Snatchers next week.
We sure do.
Watch
out. This is the first time we've tried this.
Yeah, definitely. First take. All the way, baby. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
'Hey, since you're still here and still listening, thank you, by the way, we'd like to ask an additional favor of you.
We have social media. It's a thing on the internet. And all you need to do is find us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and like and subscribe. I know this is annoying, but we have to ask you because we want more people to hear the show. In addition to that, if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we would greatly appreciate it. See you next week. Bye.